Everybody, welcome to the Untold History Channel. My name is Ron Partain, and it is Thursday, which is we were supposed to do this on Tuesday, but Mike had some technical issues at his end. I guess they imported the California governor over there, and they did a brownout or something on him. I don't know.
Well, it was a little bit hairy. The house was smoking.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were gonna, and evidently it was too much of a surge coming in. Blew out some of the surge protectors, shut everything off, and the power company handled it. I didn't have to get a local electrician, but
that's kind of spooky.
Well, good thing we're home.
Yeah,
you know, to shut everything off, but yeah, alarms were going off, and
that's kind of spooky. I'm glad you still have a house to record in.
I think Satan got pissed off after the letters. He's always after me.
Yeah, that's funny. I got the book and I left it in my room. So damn it!
I have a copy here, and you've got the PDF I sent you. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but I just wanted to show the book off, I can't. It is here. I do have it. I just don't have it here with me. So, but anyway, so before we dive in here, tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of where did this project come from? Because this is like, this isn't really standard Mike King. This is kind of a little off the wall for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely a change of pace. I mean, it is a historical artifact, yeah. But my historical specialty is really the last 250 years. Mm. I only dabble in some of the old stuff. But it was some time ago, actually, it was a reader asked me to take a look at it, see what I think. Of course, I've heard of the Shroud of Turin. I was raised Catholic. But there was never, in the Catholic Church, there was never really a definitive position. It's not part of any catechism. They just kind of leave it out there for the faithful to believe or not to believe, but it's a holy artifact. But I took a dive into it, and just what I learned about the forensics of this amazing artifact so it intrigued me, and I guess I felt the Holy Spirit move me. I gotta write this book.
You know, a question I've never...
It's not like an evangelical endeavor. It's not religious in any way. I'm just dealing with the receipts of the amazing forensic data.
Right.
Coming from scientists, secular scientists, can't explain this. And it really is remarkable in two respects. The data itself is astonishing. We'll get into that. But even more so, the fact that this is kind of not known, or very little known, even suppressed within Christianity and within Catholicism itself. I mean, it's out there. Everybody's heard about it. But they don't really get into the meat and potatoes of it. And when you do, that's when the mind is blown. So right. I had a look at it, and I'm just presenting the facts. People make their own conclusions from it. But these are undeniable facts that we're going to get into tonight.
Right. You know, I never asked you this, and I don't mean if it's too personal, then you feel free not to to say I'll decline. But are what's your heritage? Are you like Irish,
Irish, Italian? Irish, Italian, mostly Italian?
Okay,
all Catholic. You know,
all went, Catholic,
went
right?
Through the Catholic, did the sacraments, the communion, confession, and like I said, I went to the Catholic schools and was taught none of this.
Well, that's not a surprise.
Yeah. So if there's some, you know, maybe the Catholic Church doesn't want to bet all their chips on this, and then it turns out to be fraudulent. But nonetheless, the forensics should be known, should be standard in my view.
Right.
Because it's really mind-boggling stuff.
But, well, you know, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too much, but I wanted to say because I think there are similarities to, you know, to like information with the Catholic Church and how it's released and whatnot. And, you know, I mean, I look back and it's my opinion that one of probably the biggest transforming invention in human history would have been the the Gutenberg press. And when the Gutenberg press came out, I mean, you had like almost 70 years of just really unsettling in Europe, because there was a lot of people who broke away from the Catholic Church because they started reading the Bible for themselves as opposed to just listening to what the Catholic Church had to say. And I feel like the Gutenberg press 2.0 is the internet. Mm. So, and you know, all the information that we've been taught over the last, you know, 150, 250 years, it's been lies. Yeah. So, you know, and I, again, I'm not, that's not an indictment on Catholic Church. I'm just trying to draw a parallel there. So, but in any event, let's jump into the book. I'm kind of eager. I purposefully have not looked at it because I want to be, I want it to be novel for me, mm-hmm. as you talk about it. So,
okay.
So let's do this. Good. Here.
So there it is, The Divine Selfie, a crash course on the Jesus Shroud of Turin. It's available at Amazon. You can find it under my author page, which is Mike King, or Mike S. King, not Michael, and many of my other books there, paperback or Kindle format. It's also available at realnewsandhistory.com, but as always, if there's a book of mine that's that Amazon will carry, prefer to get it there, write a review, push it up the algorithms. This way other people can stumble across it.
And I did put the link to the book in the description.
Okay. Excellent.
So.
And it's, I don't know, an hour 15 read, lots of pictures. That I'm doing more of these types of works lately. I call them my crash course series.
Right. The smaller books, the hour. That, yeah, you know, the pick it up and look through it in an hour type thing.
Yeah, they tend to have a broader appeal. People are pressed for time. They just want to get to the meat of the issue. And so there it is. So that's the image. And we're going to get into this. But if you go to Turin when the Shroud is on display, that's not what you're going to see. The Shroud of Turin has the appearance almost like an impressionistic sponge painting. You don't see a discernible image. You know it's the outline of a man, but it almost looks like an amateurish artwork. Mm. You only see that image right there when you take a negative.
Really?
Yeah. And we'll get into when the first photograph of the Shroud was taken. And from that moment on, it really became a very mysterious object. But that is not the Shroud. That is a negative of the Shroud. And we're going to explain.
Gotcha. So all right. Well, you tell me how to move, because I'm gonna follow.
Yeah,
you
lead. I'll just say next panel. Yeah. Okay, go ahead. So. Okay, so the top image, that rectangle, that small rectangle, that's the Shroud. Is it's more or less 14 feet long by 3 feet wide. So the body would lay on the Shroud, and then the other half would be folded over the head. So it's covering your front and your back. And then beneath that, you see the side-by-side impressions on the Shroud. This is what you would actually see in Turin when it's on display. They only display it every few years. So clearly you see the image of a man, his hands folded. But it's not all that clear. You see what I mean? It's kind of like impressionistic.
Right.
Okay. So let's go to the next panel.
All right.
Now, what does the good book say about the linens and shrouds and cloths associated with Jesus and his burial? From the book of John, the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it says, Simon Peter came along and went straight into the tomb. He saw the linen clothes lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Two cloths, a big linen cloth, and then something that goes around the head. We'll talk about that later as well. Luke says, Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the linen cloths lying by themselves. So you've got multiple cloths corroborated by the gospel writers. So that's kind of like the context with which we attempt to interpret the Shroud of Turin.
Okay.
Next panel. And I thought I should just briefly mention Jesus in secular history. I mean, you've got some naysayers out there. They're very few, but they say, oh, there's no proof he ever even existed. Well, Jesus Christ as the historical personage, the man, absolutely did exist.
Yes.
And so it's not just the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that record his existence. In secular Roman history, there's Josephus, who was a Jewish Roman historian.
Yep.
One-liner, not much. It was Jesus Christ. He was crucified under the reign of Pontius Pilate, spawned a movement. Doesn't get into anything religious, anything like that. And then Tacitus, the official historian of the Roman Empire and a Roman senator. And you know, these weren't exact contemporaries of Jesus. They're writing like 40 years after the fact.
Right.
But to confirm his existence and crucifixion in Judea under the governor, Pontius Pilate. These are serious scholars. They're not going to just traffic in rumor. I mean, of course he existed. Because let's just say, for devil's advocate, you were going to invent. I mean, you still have to have somebody to base it on. You invent a person, not a whole cloth. So he absolutely existed. So let's get that out of the way.
Well, there are historians who did write about Christ. So not from the Bible, but you know, from writings from that period. So he absolutely existed.
Right. So that's not even a question of faith. And another thing we know from history, or that we can infer, well, actually, we know that the province of Judea was always a big problem for the Romans. They were always rebelling, always stirring up shit, the usual suspects, you know.
Nothing's changed.
And at one time, the Romans even had special coins minted for that region, because they said, oh, we can't have Caesar on the coin, you know. That's so it's like, okay, they're always trying to pacify them. And then there was like a violent sect. They were known as the Zealots. That's where the word zealotry comes from.
Really?
That's the name of their sect. Yeah. The Jewish sect, always rebelling. That's what Hanukkah is about. Rebellion of the Zealots against the Greeks. So it's big problems. And all the Romans wanted is order. They wanted their taxes and obey the laws. That's it. They don't care about your local religion or your culture, your language, whatever. Okay. But because they were so unruly, they had to appease them from time to time. Finally, in the year 66 AD, they said, screw that. Titus came in and wiped them out, busted up Jerusalem, scattered them to the winds, sacked the city. And that's what the Arch of Titus in Rome is all about. And you even see it's carved into it. You see the depiction of Roman soldiers carrying out menorah and everything. So they really got sick of it 30 years after Jesus.
Well, and that was what and that was one of the big writings of Josephus, was the Jewish war.
Yeah.
You know, 80, I think it was 80, was it 60, 66, 67 to about AD 70 when the temple was destroyed. So
So that's real. And we also know, if we just back up a second, that from the accounts in the New Testament, that Jesus was also a fighter. So it's not just peace, love type of.
The story. Yeah, the stories of him throwing all the money changers out of the temple.
Yeah, he fashioned a whip, which implies premeditated anger. He didn't just grab a whip, he fashioned it. He says, I'm going to get these MFers. Okay. And then just in the New Testament, you hypocrites, you sons of the devil. Okay, so now just through inference, we can piece together what happened, and it's really corroborated by the New Testament. He took it to the Pharisees, and naturally they would go to Pontius Pilate and say, we got to get this guy out. That's the Israeli lobby of the day. They did a Gaddafi on him, a Saddam Hussein on him, a Hitler on him.
Exactly.
It's nothing changes. Okay, so we pretty much know that story. At the behest of the Jewish elders, Jesus was condemned to horrible death, which the Romans would not have done on their own. It's just an appeasement. because again, they don't care about that kind of, that stuff.
Right.
As long as you pay your taxes, obey the law, and don't cause trouble, they don't care about the religious matters.
Yeah.
Next panel. All right, those are scenes from Mel Gibson's movie. And when we get into the shroud and the forensics of it, that movie was no exaggeration. I mean, as horrible as it was to watch, that's exactly how they took it to him. They really brutalized him with spiked whips and crowned him with thorns and crucified him, all at the behest of the Pharisees.
Yep. That was, I've only ever been able to watch that movie one time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we have a little bit of context that most people already know, but it's a good little review. Let's talk about the historical journey of the shroud. It was stored in Constantinople. It was passed down generation to generation by the early Christians. And that's at a time where, I suppose, if you were caught with a relic like this, it was death, because the early Christians were persecuted for the first few hundred years. Until Rome adopted Christianity as the official state religion. And the West, Roman Catholic Church. In the East, the Orthodox Church, kind of like sister churches.
Right.
The Knights Templar got a hold of it from Constantinople. So it seemed like there was one of the Crusades was actually Christian on Christian. Typically, they went and they tried to push back the Muslims. And, you know, the Crusades were not these expansionist, imperialist things that the left fake historians teach. No, it was centuries of encroachment from, like, the Moors and the Turks. This is the Europe pushing back, trying to reclaim what's stolen from them, because this was all part of the Western world at one point, Syria, Palestine, North Africa, so on. But anyway, it was during the Crusades, the Knights Templar brought it back to France. They brought it to France circa 15. Oh, that's a typo. I transposed the number. 1350, it's brought to France. And it's kept in a church in France. And the Pope at that time, Pope Clement, was skeptical. He declared that it was a relic, but he didn't take a position on its authenticity. And that's pretty much been the position of the Catholic Church all along. They don't tell you what to think about it. So that's the journey, the oral history. Judea, modern-day Palestine. Turkey, Constantinople, which was the capital of the Roman Empire, the eastern half. Now it's Istanbul, Turkey.
Istanbul.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then it ended up in France. Okay. Next panel. Now, nearly two centuries later, in 1532, a fire nearly destroys the shroud. Very bad fire. The cathedral caught fire. I don't think these things are accidental.
Because nope.
Because if you study Satanism, which is really a topic I didn't really get into until Q came along, I always knew there were weirdos who practiced that, but now I am convinced that it's something at elite levels that passes down century to century.
I agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this was a horrible fire, and the shroud was kept in a case, and it had like metal around the rims. It actually started melting. You see the marks on it to this day. So it and the cloth itself might have even caught fire, but they managed to get it out. So it was very, very nearly destroyed in 1532. And there's an old medieval image of some bishops or cardinals holding the shroud lengthwise, and it's head to head. You see the back of the body and the front of the body because it's folded over. So that's 1532. Next panel. 6 years later, the House of Savoy, who were the kings of France, which at that time the kingdom encompassed northern Italy as well, they moved it to Turin, the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist, where it is to this day, and that's where it takes its name from. It's the Shroud of Turin, but it was once the Shroud of Constantinople, then the Shroud of France, but now it's the Shroud of Turin, and it's been there ever since, 500 years now. So all of these centuries, dating back from the very beginning, 2,000 years ago, this is passed down generation to generation and revered as the amongst the faithful as the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. But now subsequent generations, they have the only thing they have to go on is faith, really. It's not until 1898 that you begin to, this was the first bit of evidence in its favor. You could call it forensic evidence, actually. A photographer, he's actually an attorney and an amateur photographer. Photography is what, 40, 50 years old at this time. Okay. Right. He is granted the privilege of being able to take the first ever photograph of the Shroud of Turin. And we've seen what the Shroud looks like, that impressionistic, almost abstract image of a man, but no discernible images. Well, Segundo Pio takes the photo, and you see there in the museum there, that's his original camera, and that's the image that shows up on his glass. And because as you know, back then, before the age of instant photos with iPhones,
right,
you took a picture, and then you took the little roll out of your camera, the negative, you brought it to CVS, you pick it up a few days later, you're all excited to see your color photos. Of course, it wasn't like that back then. You had a negative. It wasn't even film.
Right.
The image on a plate of glass, and you went in the dark room, you develop, and you convert the negative to a positive image. So here's what Pio says. I'll let him explain. He said, "Closed in my dark room, all intent on my work, I experienced a very strong emotion when, during the development, I saw for the first time the Holy Face appear on the plate with such clarity that I was dumbfounded by it. No human being could have painted this negative that lies hidden in the stains. It was not painted and not made by human hands." So in other words, the image on the linen is the negative. So when you take a negative of a negative, he comes up with this positive, and you see this perfect image of a man, and everything is discernible. The nose, the lips, the beard, the wounds. So he later said he almost dropped the plate almost. He was like so shocked at what he saw, because he's expecting to see something even more unclear. He's expecting to see a negative of that impressionistic image, but instead he gets that image there. Okay. So here's what I mean. We remember these negatives.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the 35 or the 30 and under crowd will look at that and say, "What's that?"
35 millimeter.
Yeah. But that's what your camera produces, a negative, what the camera's used to produce. Okay. For example, like that image of the little girl, you look at her face, you can't tell anything. It's a negative. But then they develop it in the dark room. They have certain chemicals, et cetera. And then you get the crystal clear, perfect replica of reality there, the picture of the little girl. Now, look at the two Jesus pictures just below. The first one is the shroud. It looks just like the little girl. That vague kind of outline, that's a negative. And then the negative of the negative, look what it yielded. Look at the definition, the brow, the nose, the mustache, the beard, the bloodstains, and the body, the fingers, the wounds, anatomically perfect. So that is a negative image on the shroud yielding a positive. How is that possible? There was no photography 2,000 years ago.
Right.
How does the artist know what he's doing? Is he making a so-called artwork and thinking to himself, "You know, I'm really clever, because 2,000 years from now, they're going to invent photography and then they'll see my image"? No, of course not. Now, the naysayers at the time, I mean, this was all over the Italian newspapers of 1898. People believed them, but then you had the critics, the naysayers, the skeptics, saying this guy's a fraudster. He pulled a fast one. They didn't believe it. And it was not for an additional 33 years, not until 1931, that another photographer was permitted to take pictures, Giuseppe Henri. And by this time, the photography is even more sophisticated. And lo and behold, he yields the same exact results. Those are his images there. There's the whole body shot. And there's the third image, which is actually the cover of my book. Got the same results. You see this perfect wow. image of a man from a linen, which you can't even see what the image is. So, and Segundo Pio was still alive at this time, and Henri had invited him to the event, some sort of press conference, and he was vindicated because he lived with this little stigma for the last 33 years. Did he pull some kind of scam? No. So that's quite a mystery. No one can explain this. This is photographic imagery. There's just no doubt about it. It's a negative.
What are these images?
Those blotches, those lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's from the fire of 1532 began to melt the casing. So that's like molten metal was dripping all over it.
Gotcha.
Okay. So it was damaged, but it survived. So that's how close it came to being incinerated forever in 1532.
Interesting.
Okay. So here we are again. Now there's a full body shot. There's the shroud. All the properties of a negative that you would get from your film. Next to it is the negative of the negative, which you're not supposed to see, which so shocked Segundo Pio. And in the third image, the image actually has 3D properties. I suppose you need some special mechanism to be able to detect that, but you can see the 3D properties of the image, so you can determine like depth and so on. So it's more than just like a photo. It's almost like a scan, a CAT scan. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Super sophisticated.
You know, one thing that I notice here is on this image is this blotch right here.
Yeah.
And then on here, it's obviously the reverse.
Right.
And I'm wondering, is that the wound of because
the nails?
Yeah, from the nail. As I understand it, the modern, everybody thinks it was in his hands. They didn't do it into the hand. There wasn't enough, like meat and muscle and bone to hold you up. They actually, where they did it was they did it into the wrist.
That's right. Right
here. And that looks very close to where it would have been, like if it was in the wrist.
Yeah. Now that's what I got. There's two bones here. And what's interesting, if you like really squeeze on this hard, like you'll see your thumb involuntarily tuck in. Mm-hmm. Imagine what a nail would do. And right. Indeed, on the image, his thumbs are not visible because it was locked in, and then your rigor mortis sets in. So his thumbs are locked in. And that's just portrayed in the image. You know, no artist is going to think of that. Okay. And it's anatomically perfect images. Nobody could even sketch like that until Leonardo came along. Okay.
Right.
So that's where we stood for the longest time. Now, so now you've got the 2,000-year oral history and deep faith that it's authentic. Then you have the Segundo Pio photos in 1898 and then additional photos in 1931. It's not until 1978... that we get more advanced technology to have a look at this artifact. In 76, a pair of scientists began assembling a team, John Jackson and Eric Jumper, and 30 other experts from various fields formed the Shroud of Turin Research Project, STRP for short. So they got physicists, they got experts on chemistry and experts on fabric and blood and radiology, everything you think, all these various fields, all these scientists, forensic scientists. And most of them, they actually did a poll just to kind of see where people's minds were of the STRP team before. And as you might expect, most of them are atheists or agnostics. There were some Jews, there were some Catholics. There were only two people on the team who believed this to be authentic. And the rest were either skeptical or they thought it's bullshit. We're going to find out the truth. So that's where their minds are. But they were professionals, and everything about this project is just the facts, just forensic data. They did not have any kind of agenda. However, they did feel almost to a man that going in that they were going to be the ones to finally crack this mystery of how they did it. So the STIRP team was purely scientific. What they found profoundly surprised them.
All right. Here we go.
Okay. So they did things like capture samples from the shroud. Everything from blood to the fabric to the pollen. They used adhesive tape. They captured 32 samples. And when they arrived, these are the main conclusions, the main points of the STIRP project, which they announced at the end. Number one, there are no paint, oil, or scorch marks anywhere on the shroud. The source of the image, which only affects the tippy-top microns of the fibers, remains of unknown origin. No paint, no stain, no scorch, no artist. Number two, nothing was drawn by strokes nor by dotted art techniques. That's not where the image comes from. So they totally ruled out artistry. Number three, the human blood stains are real. And it's the very rare type AB positive. Only 3% of men have AB positive blood. Number four, the pattern of the blood stains is consistent with those of a man who was crowned with thorns and flogged mercilessly. You see all the wounds.
Wow.
Okay. I'm gonna show you later on what that looked like, but they could detect all the whip marks. And actually, they say it wasn't a crown of thorns. It was more like a helmet of thorns. It wasn't just the perimeter. They're jamming them on top of the head. Two men carried out the flogging with spiked whips. Would have little pieces of metal or bone at the end to really tear into your flesh. And they were even able to determine that one man was taller than the other guy from the angle of the whip marks.
Wow.
Number five, some of the blood which stained the shroud had previously bled out onto the body from a still living man as he's being whipped, as he's being nailed. He's alive. And that blood's coming up. That's live blood. But some of the other blood oozed out after death. Obviously, at the moment of death, the properties of your blood change. The blood's no longer being oxygenated, for example.
Right.
So they can tell
the heart's not pumping and there's no blood. There's no oxygen coming in from the lungs.
And they can detect that. So it's both. The blood came from a man who was living, who later died and continued to ooze. Number six, the properties of the blood samples reveal the presence of a trauma-induced chemical known as bilirubin secreted from the liver. It's indicative of someone who had been tortured and terrorized. Similar in some respects to adrenochrome, right? I mean, when you're under extreme stress and you're tortured, terrorized, your body's pumped, that's in your blood. That's why you're feeling that reaction. So this man was tortured, and it's in the blood. Number eight. Hey, what happened to number seven? Oh, that's okay. The blood stained the fabric first. The superficial image of a tortured man happened afterwards. So he's laid out on a cloth. He's all bloody. But this event that this was able to capture his image happens afterwards. And they can tell because there's areas where there's blood. There's no image on top of the blood stains. It doesn't take on blood stains. It takes on the linen, not on the blood stains. So the blood came first, then the image. Number nine, there is an image of a spear wound on the side of the body.
Wow.
Completely consistent with the gospel accounts. Got a big stab mark right here. And that's post-mortem blood that oozed out because he's dead already. Mm-hmm. The gospels say he was stabbed in the side with a spear. The Romans wanted to make sure he was dead before they pulled him down off the cross. This is all forensics. This is not theoretical science that's supported by rigged math equations or computer models, nothing like that. These are just the facts. This is the essence of science. Forensic science, experimental science, none of these points are disputed. They can't be disputed. That's why these guys, their minds were blown. That's the 1978 STIRP. That gentleman there in the first image, that Dr. John Heller, he delivers the final word on STIRP. I have a lengthy excerpt from his amazing statement. It's in the book, The Divine Selfie, here. But he states, quote, "We can conclude for now that the shroud image is that of a real human form of a scourged, crucified man. It is not the product of an artist. That's a fact. Okay. Another image there, that's Alvin Adler. He was the expert on blood chemistry. And he confirmed, and it's since been reconfirmed, that the blood on the shroud was indeed that of a man who had been tortured and released, bilirubin. Now, what you're seeing in this image, I mean, there's the negative, which is a positive.
Yep.
And from that, a mannequin was made, which depicts the wounds based off of what you can see on the shroud in terms of what's visible as far as the wounds go and also from the blood marks. So that's just making it clearer. So you see, there he was nailed in the wrist between two bones. Because you put it in your palm, it's going to, you'll probably rip. Okay. Yep. So it's in the right place. His knees are badly scraped. That's consistent with the gospel accounts. He kept falling down with that heavy cross. You see the spear wound on the side. You see the blood flowing from the head, the crown of thorns. So that's exactly how it is. So it's not like an imagination type thing. This is from the shroud. Perfectly matches the accounts in the New Testament and makes you realize that Mel Gibson wasn't exaggerating in that flick. He stayed pretty true
right
to what actually happened based on the shroud. Real blood. Now 1988 comes along. Carbon dating debunks the shroud. Oh, isn't that a shame? I remember when my mother heard this on the news. She was so disappointed. I'm trying to console her. Mom, don't worry about it. It's still a miracle. How did the image get on there? But this was big. It was all over the news that night. Fake news. They only had the three networks. All of them. Dan Rather, everybody. This was one of their lead stories. The shroud is fake. New York Times, Washington Post, all over. So what happened is the Vatican allowed a new team of scientists to test the shroud with a relatively new procedure known as the carbon 14 dating. They tested the shroud and it came back. You see the date range there on the blackboard, 1260 to 1390. And these scientists were so proud of themselves, you know, they even put an exclamation point after the 1390. Just you see, it's fake. So there's a headline, New York Times, torn shroud shown to be a fake. There's the three scientists from three different laboratories posing in front of the British Museum. This study was undertaken under the auspices of the British Museum. They're all proud of themselves. And what they did is, I mean, obviously the church had to allow them to cut a little sample from the cloth for this. They were gracious enough to do that. They did their tests, and they leaked it to the press. That's a real dick move. They didn't go to the church.
Right.
They just went behind their back, leaked it to the press. So that kind of puts the church in like a corner.
Mm-hmm.
If you had done it privately, they could say, well, what was your methodology? We want to have some other people take a look at it. Second.
Yeah, let's get a second opinion. Yeah.
But they outmaneuvered them. So the hype came first, and then the church just went along with it. And, you know, once the Vatican declared it's not 2,000 years old, it was game over. And this was very demoralizing for the faithful. Major black pill. The carbon 14 dating. And you'll see on the next page.
Just trust us because we say so.
Right. Yeah. But it was a double whammy because the church went along with it, you see?
Well, yeah.
But
by that point, the church had been compromised.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. There's infiltrators in the church. It's partially that, partially cowardice. Because now, if we question it, we'll look like we're in denial. And you know, also at this time, I think it's a little bit different of a culture in the 80s. I mean, today this stuff wouldn't fly so easily because we're. I mean, a lot of normies still worship fake science, of course, but I think a lot more people are awake.
Right.
If they were back then, people would have said, well, you know, wait a minute. let's have another look at this. Can we? Are you sure? But there, the New York Times Church says the shroud is not authentic. Now look at all these headlines. They're gleeful. Fake news. Fake accompli. Turin shroud was the work of a medieval master forger. Huge. Like I said, a huge black pill. And the legend of the shroud seemed dead forever. So that the church's new position was, well, we still don't know how this image got on the cloth. That could still be a miracle, but it's not 2,000 years old. So that's it. Shroud is dead. Or is it? Now, in the year 2000, and what I'm going to describe to you actually transpires over nearly 20 years, but it started in the year 2000. The 1988 debunk is itself debunked. Or so says this couple right here. That's Susan Benford and Joseph Marino. They're shroud enthusiasts, shroud promoters, okay? But they're not scientists. Susan Benford is a nurse, and I think Marino has some kind of technical background, but they're not actual scientists. But what she noticed just from pictures of the pieces of the shroud that were tested, she looked at it closely and she theorized it doesn't quite match. There's all anomalies. What if this was part of the repair work that was done in 1530s after the fire? And that's known history that there were some the nuns, they were like some amazing seamstresses, did repair work on the shroud that she could not even tell if it was the original or not. But she could with her keen eye. Now, the problem is no one's going to listen to these people. They're not scientists, right? However, one of the STIRP team members, his name was Barry Schwartz, Jewish guy, isn't this ironic, kind of made it his life's work to promote the shroud. He was so moved by it. At a website and everything, lecture circuit, books, tireless advocate in favor of the shroud's authenticity. They presented it to Bernie Schwartz in the early 2000s. Bernie Schwartz puts it on his website, and then he contacts that gentleman on the far right there. He's another STIRP scientist, the original STIRP members, Ray Rogers. And Ray Rogers doesn't believe it. He says to Barry, these people aren't scientists. You know, they got to let it go. This is nonsense. They're saying it's not the right cloth, etc. But he said, I'll take a look at it. He still had samples from 78. So he put that under the microscope, and then he looked closely at the images. He said, holy crap, it's a different weave or a different fabric. It doesn't look the same. So now the 1988 debunking is now in question. The shroud is back in play. However, they needed to get at the original data from the 1988. They wouldn't release it. The British Museum had it.
Oh, what a shocker.
It's been out for years.
Yeah. They won't release it just like they won't release the Pike Mazzini letter. Oh, no, we don't have it. That doesn't exist.
Yeah. Lots of stuff they won't release. They don't release the dinosaur bones. They don't release the climate change. That's
right.
That's an indicator, because with true science, that's the first thing you want to do is throw it open to the public. Hey, everybody, have at it. Peer review. Check our work.
Yep. Oh. That's the whole point.
Yep. What are you hiding? So what happens next? Finally, a court order. In Britain, just like here, they have FOIA. Freedom of Information Act. A FOIA request was filed, and it took the force of British law to finally say, release that data. And indeed they did, and what they found is the methodology was so bad that it had to be deliberate. Of course it was deliberate. That's why they didn't want to release it. What these sons of bitches did, Ron, is in violation of all scientific methods and protocols, instead of doing like multiple samples from different parts of the shroud, they keyed in on one area of the shroud, took one sample, and it just happened to be from where the repair work was done, took that one sample, cut it in three, sent it out to three different laboratories to create the illusion of independent corroboration from multiple sources, and they all come back dating it to medieval times. It's a fake. That's what they did, those sons of bitches. And since that time, new, more advanced, and more accurate procedures than even carbon-14 have been developed. In the second image, you see Dr. Giulio Fanti. He dated the shroud using a technique known as spectrometry. And guess what? Comes out to 2,000 years old, give or take. Nobody disputes it. And it was later repeated. The shroud is indeed 2,000 years old. Problem is, the 1988 hype job is still in people's heads. And a lot of people to this day will say, oh, no, don't you remember? They dated it. It's only 800 years old. So that they heavily publicized. But the debunk of the debunk, you know, back pages in the paper. But that's the truth. It's 2,000 years old after all. And Marino wrote a book, the 1988 C-14 dating of the Shroud of Turin, a stunning expose when he gets into all the fraud. It's not bad science. It was fraudulent. They did it on purpose. Of course they did it on purpose. That was their intention all along. That's why they went around the church's back and still telling the church. They went to the press. Okay. That's why they fought it in the court. It took 19 years. So this is relatively recent now that the shroud has been redated. So everything's back in play now. You've got Sturp, and now you've got the right date. So the shroud has been resurrected. No pun intended. We'll go to the next panel here. So it did get some mention in the news, very little. Nothing like the 1988, but that's the Express of London, Jesus Christ bombshell. The Shroud of Turin hoax claims are ruled out, but is it the face of God? The Shroud of Turin could hold the real face of Jesus Christ, etc. I'm just going to read this excerpt from the bottom. July 2019, a new paper published in the Oxford University Journal, Archaeometry, has challenged the validity of the methods used in the original study. The 1988 dating was done on small snippets of the shroud taken from the edges of the cloth. In the new study, however, researchers argue the method was flawed because it did not analyze the shroud as a whole. The new study followed a successful lawsuit to gain access to the original data collected in 1988. And then came the spectrometry. So it did get some press, but not as much as it should have. That's not a surprise. Next panel. Now, there are other proofs, forensic proofs of age and origin. It's amazing what these forensics can turn up. So, like, what's that TV show? CSI?
Remember CSI? That's- CSI, yeah. I think, yeah, probably CSI. I don't know. I don't watch television, yeah. So.
They found on the shroud pollen. Now, pollen gets into everything. If you've never known anyone with pollen allergies, how much they suffer during pollen season, or you see it all over your car. Pollen gets everywhere. There's so many thousands of species of plants. Most plants are indigenous to a certain area of the world. They found on the shroud pollen that is unique to Palestine, also known as the shitty little state these days, but I prefer to call it Palestine or Judea of the day. And the pollen doesn't lie. The shroud was in Jerusalem at one time. And then it also shows that there's pollen unique to Turkey and Western Europe. So the pollen matches the oral history of the shroud. Jerusalem, Constantinople, France to Italy. It's almost like fingerprints. Next panel. They're able to detect the presence of Roman coins on the eyelids, and then they brought in a numismatic expert, coin collecting expert, saying that those coins appear to be from the Judea in that time period. This was physicists John Jackson and Eric Jumper, who are also original STIRP members, they were the original organizers, they detected the presence of Roman coins holding down the eyelids.
Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Is that putting coins over the eyes? Was that a practice in that day?
I think it's been a practice even like in more recent times. I don't think it's like anything to do with ritual. I think it's just to keep the eyes shut because I think involuntarily they open up again. So next panel, limestone match on the shroud. Again, this is a spectrometric analysis, the same that they use for dating, Dr. Giulio Fanti. On the shroud, it revealed trace remnants of limestone dirt on the nose, the knee, the heel. Again, this is consistent with the gospel accounts. Jesus keeps falling down, falling on his face. He's been whipped. He's tired. The cross is heavy. And it's a limestone trail. The dirt is from a rare limestone identical to that found in Jerusalem to this day.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, everything is just perfect. This is something nobody would even think about. Now, remember when I read those quotes from Luke and John about the linens in the tomb? There was the linen and there was a cloth around the head. His face would have been so badly bloodied and bruised, just out of respect, they put a linen. It's called a sudarium around his head. Take him to the tomb so you don't see him all mangled up like that. And in the tomb, they removed the sudarium, and there it is in the gospel accounts. The cloth that was wrapped around his head, and then there's the linen, which is the shroud. This, the sudarium and the shroud, went on diverging paths. Okay, so somehow the sudarium ends up in Spain. It was probably in Constantinople as well at one time. Ends up in Spain. King Alfonso has it preserved in a gold-plated ark like that. So this is the cloth that was used to cover the head of Jesus. It's covered in blood. Is what's interesting. The blood patterns, the bleeding patterns on the sudarium Oviedo match the shroud perfectly. The head wounds, and I think like over 30 head wounds and facial wounds match up. Okay. Furthermore, when the blood was tested, it also came up AB positive. Perfect match with the shroud. That's only 3% of men. 3% times 3%. Okay. And the pollen, again, Palestine. So those are the two garments that got separated. Only this doesn't have an image on it. Just has the blood. Why? Because it was removed. They would have removed it prior to laying him out on the slab. Now,
did they test the blood on this? Did it match the blood? Did they do DNA?
DNA? No, I don't know if they had DNA capability like that to extract it from a little bit of blood back in 1978. But they do know the blood type. But that's why we need to get back in there. Because I think now I'm sure they could, because just people speculate he's not going to have the DNA of an earthly father. He'll just have his mother's DNA. Let's see. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yeah.
But that's the facial covering. So for the blood type to match like that, the blood pattern, the pollen. So yeah, this is real too. It doesn't have an image because remember what I said, the blood comes first. Than the image.
And the blood was, and the blood here also, like you said, was...
Same blood type. The rarest blood type of all men, by the way. 3%. 1977, another fire. Bad. All cathedrals in Italy. This one here gets torched. Cathedral of St. John, containing the Shroud of Turin. And this was a horrific fire. It was saved by a heroic fireman who went in there and he had his mates just dousing the area with water. They couldn't contain the fire. But he figured just keep the area cool. He was banging away through bulletproof glass and metal with a sledgehammer for 15 minutes. People were lining the streets of Turin around the cathedral, crying. And finally, he emerges with the shroud and became an instant rock star. His name is Mario Tremontore. He was later declared hero of Italy. He saved the shroud. But more significantly now, is this is not accidental either. Is there a satanic Masonic plot to burn the shroud? Indeed, there is. And I'm going to present some interesting data here in support of that. Next panel. It just so happened that in that complex, there's an adjoining hall connected to the cathedral. And there was an event taking place there. United Nations, they were honoring Kofi Annan. And this is the demonic, satanic New World Order United Nations we're talking about, right? They're honoring Kofi Annan. And in this area, in this hall, which is not right where the shroud is, but it's adjoining, it's the same building, they're having cocktails. Kofi Annan, Andreotti, Prime Minister of Italy, globalist, the guy from Fiat, what's his name? I forget his name. Fiat, big globalist, you know, Fiat later merged with Chrysler under Obama. So all these characters are there with their entourages and their security people, and then they leave. It's later determined by the Turin Fire Department, they're part of their investigation, that while the event was wrapping up, the fire had already started. Interesting coincidence. But they say, oh, there's no connection. There's no conspiracy. There was some work going on. Some people were careless. Bullshit.
Just like Notre Dame.
Cathedral. Notre Dame. Yep. Just like Notre Dame. That's Emmanuel Macron's deal. And remember, Michelle Obama's right there drinking champagne on the river cruise as it's burning.
Yep.
They're Satanists.
But I'll talk about that here in a second. I'll let you finish.
Okay. This gentleman here is Vittorio Massari. He is Pope John Paul's official historiographer. And he was very firm. He was saying stuff that maybe the church felt they couldn't say, but they used him as a front. And he was very strong that this was some sort of plot, satanic, Masonic plot. Globalist New World Order. He didn't say globalist New World Order, but that's what it is. It was just too much going on. I mean, the UN is there, and then the fire starts. But he writes, believe me, someone wanted to burn the shroud. I do not exclude an international plot, and I would suspect Masonic circles, the usual suspects. So that's twice that the shroud has almost been destroyed and was saved heroically. Almost like it's God protected.
Right.
Now, in digging a little deeper, I learned that Turin is known as like a haven for Satanists, which would kind of make sense because you got the shroud there. You would think that the Satanists would want to offset that type of divine positive energy with their own presence in the city. But Turin is like their Italian capital of Satanism. That's a headline there. This is before the fire. 1986, does Satan lurk in Turin or just some amateurs? LA Times, 1990, Turin is getting a devil of a time. The city has a reputation as a haven for Satan and his disciples. The Catholic Church has 6 exorcists on duty. So it's just too perfect. You got the UN, the Satanists, etc.
Well, you know, in the scriptures, it actually talks about the sky, the stars in the sky, and a certain stars in a specific position, and they've analyzed that, and they narrowed it down to there was only like a one hour window of when Christ's birth occurred according to the scriptures. And that date would have been September 11th.
That's so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now think about this, and again, not trying to go down a rabbit hole, but what is the astrological sign of September 11th? Virgo.
Virgo.
Oh, Virgin.
I love that. Yeah.
Virgin. Okay. What's the sign if you start with Virgo being the first sign and you go all the way to the last one, to the one just before Virgo, what is that? Leo.
Leo.
What is Leo?
Lion.
The king of the jungle. The king. Right. The king.
Yeah.
So there are many people who believe that the story of Christ is told in the stars. So, the point I was making there is that, you know, you talk about 9/11, if it's September the 11th is his birth, and how many really horrific events have occurred on that day.
Yeah. Well, it would stand to reason, that they would want to parallel that and offset it.
Right.
So there it is. I mean, you would have had the manpower on the streets to get somebody to do it, but then you add to that the potential protective cover of UN bigwigs. Yeah, that was another Notre Dame job. They wanted to get rid of the shroud. Now, as to the question of what could have caused that image, again, John Jackson of STIRP, he's older now, but he's still investigating, and Paolo Di Lazzaro of the Frascati Research Center in Rome, they posit that intense UV light would have caused the image. And a light so intense, I think they calculated it out to, like, I don't know how many gazillions of watts. But it's something that even the most powerful, sophisticated lasers can't even approach today. Okay? And yet, without heat, because the amount of heat associated with such an intense light would disintegrate the shroud in an instant, but it didn't. So that's the theory, intense light. Some say it was radiating from within him. Some say it's external. I mean, these are all speculations. But one thing that is clear, only an intense light of unimaginable proportions could have taken that selfie. Okay? Another speculation here onto the light and what happened. It's not speculation that an intense light caused the image, not in my book. But as to where it came from, you know, that's, we don't know yet. But Father Robert J. Spitzer, president of Gonzaga University from 1998 to 2009, he's also a scientific background. He writes, the known laws of physics cannot explain how a decaying human body could emit such an intense burst of vacuum ultraviolet radiation, or how a body could become transparent. This leads many to conclude that the image on the Shroud of Turin has a transphysical cause, possibly tied to the resurrection of Christ. Jesus' resurrection involved more than returning to life. His body transformed into a glorified transphysical state. The Shroud may be evidence of this transformation, captured through a miraculous burst of radiation.
Interesting.
These are plausible scenarios, radiation from within the body, external light, but one thing that to me is not speculative is intense light of origins that we can't imagine made this image. Now here's an easy $1 million. Anyone wants to go for it. David Rolfe, he's a British filmmaker, was an atheist. And he was doing a documentary on the Shroud. He's another one, think he could debunk it. Now he's a Christian. How about that? There's a lot of cases of this.
Sounds to me like sounds like a case of what's the guy's name from Chicago? He was the he wrote a book called he was a guy, he did the legal section for the Chicago Tribune, and his wife became a Christian, and he went out to go to debunk it, and he went through talked to all these scientists and all this other stuff, and it turned out that he's like there's no way in hell that this could be, that it could have happened just miraculous. I mean, that it just could have just miraculously happened without some sort of intelligent design. His name will come to me.
Now, there's a lot of such characters, but this Shroud in particular has triggered this in a number of people. And this is very recent. It's from The Guardian, April 17, 2022. The $1 million challenge. Who?
Lee Strobel. Thank you.
Strobel. Okay.
Lee Strobel. Anyway.
If the Turin Shroud is a forgery, show how it was done. And Rolf says, they said it was created by a medieval fraudster. And I tell him, well, if he could do it, you should be able to do it too. And if you can, I've got a $1 million reward for you. I encourage you to repeat this thing by creating something similar today. Because all of the evidence I have seen, if it is a fake, it is the most ingenious fake in history. So far, no takers.
So he was an atheist that became a Christian as a result of the Shroud.
Yeah, right. And he's got wow. He's putting up $1 million of his own money for people to duplicate it. Nobody took him up on it. They can't. And, you know, $1 million, that would just be chump change, because if you were able to duplicate this and fulfill the conditions of his challenge, the fake news would put, they would have put so much fame, okay, so much hype to your name that, you know, imagine the book deals, the lecture circuit, become a multimillionaire if you could crack this code. But nobody did. Nobody will. They can't. They absolutely can't. Cannot be duplicated. Barry Schwartz, I wanted to mention Barry Schwartz for a number of reasons. First of all, he was the one who kind of really inspired me, because his videos are all over the internet. He's given lectures, podcasts. This became his lifelong passion. He's an original member of the STIRP team. He was a medical scientific photography expert. That's why he was invited by one of the STIRP physicists who knew him and done work for him. And he said, I'm not interested. I'm Jewish. This is Catholic stuff. It's not for me. You have to be persuaded. And then ultimately, he felt, well, I'm going to get a free trip to Italy out of the deal. We'll go there. We'll find the paint or the stain. We'll crack the mystery. Come on. Instead, he comes out basically evangelized. I mean, he's not converted to Christianity or anything, but he's a total believer in the authenticity of the Shroud. And he's so juiced up about it when he talks about it. There he is in 1978. But he, more than anybody, I think, is in the modern time, has schooled more people on some of these facts that I'm presenting to you today. And I was going to reach out to him for an interview for this book and possibly the write the foreword. I come to find out he recently passed away a few months later,
oh,
3 months ago. Okay. But he also deserves credit for, in many ways, for resurrecting the Shroud. Because remember when I talked earlier about Susan Benford? Mm-hmm. She thought something was off with the fabric. Nobody would have taken her seriously, but she knew Barry Schwartz because he's a Shroud activist in a sense. And he was able to act as a conduit and put it into the STIRP pipeline and get it to Ray Rogers, who then came back and now with scientific authority. There's an important lesson here too, because the humble woman here, the lowly nurse who's not a scientist, she had it right. Okay, Ray Rogers didn't believe her, but then Ray Rogers came along. So now it had the official approval of forensic science behind it. And from that came the process to get the Freedom of Information Act and to get the 1988 information and debunk the debunk. But he was the point man on this.
Wow.
Without him, people would have just said, yeah, Susan Benford, she's crazy, right? So isn't that interesting? A Jew shaves the Shroud.
I know. I was just thinking the same thing.
It inspires me, the author of The Bad War. That's how that works. Yeah.
When I think of him, I Benjamin Friedman.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. He was another one. That's right. Yep. So, I tell you what. Once you convert one of them, they become bulldogs.
Oh yeah.
On your side, you know. So.
Well, you know, it's when you shake the lies. And you see things and you analyze them for what they really are. I have a friend who's just, I mean, she, all she sees is racism and Trump's horrible and all this other stuff. And it's like, you know, I don't believe that she's ever really given him an honest chance. She's just, you know, she listens to MSNBC too much or CNN or whatever it is. And it's just, you know, if anybody took the time to actually be intellectually honest and analyze it without a preconceived bias, you will come to the conclusion that some of these guys have.
Right.
And I mean, that's across the board. That's not just about this particular topic.
Yeah. That's true. So this is from the final section of my booklet. I talk about the hateful bias against the Shroud. And I quote from Matthew, where Jesus says, "You will be hated because of me." And indeed, this Shroud is hated. Now, I'm not talking about those who remain skeptical or don't believe. There's something deeper with a lot of these characters. They really hate this idea. What would motivate these so-called scientists from 1988 to fudge the forensics of it? That's pretty deep. Okay, give us the real date. Test, take the proper random samples and give us the real date. If you don't want to believe in it, fine, but to manipulate data like that, there's something deep going on. And there's a lot of hatred for this artifact. You got the fire in 1532. You got the fire in 1997. There it is. This is just a small example. That's the amazing Randy, James Randy. He's dead now, but he was a magician. But his shtick was to debunk like supernatural con artists and stuff. And a lot of his stuff was actually solid. But he's also was a radical atheist, outspoken atheist, just hated religion, God, Christianity, all that stuff. And he talks about the Shroud. He was in Turin. He says, "I was in Italy when the fabulous Shroud of Turin was again being displayed to the eagerly gullible." Well, why would you go there? You know, just to start trouble. This huge rag, so thoroughly and authoritatively discredited by experts, that's a lie, was guarded by garishly costumed volunteers who glowered at me, perhaps because I resembled a rabbi. But, you know, you could just feel like the hatred and the animosity coming out of them for this.
Yeah.
And that kind of explains why this thing remains buried. It should be a big, a constant big news story. You'd think there would be big teams of scientists assembled. Now, this here wraps it all up. Image on the far left, that's the Shroud of Turin. That's what it looks like. Again, you really can't discern any kind of image. It looks amateurish, impressionistic. Then you take a negative and it comes to life. And that handsome young fellow there, that is AI-generated Jesus based on the Shroud.
Wow.
Okay, so they cleaned them up. Fixed his face up, took away some of the swelling, and obviously, you know, he would have been in bad shape. But just from the general bone structure, this is what AI makes him look like. He looks like Jim Caviezel.
Yeah. Impressive.
Yeah. All right. So there it is. The divine selfie is only like $14. Those of you of faith, this will strengthen it, protect it, whatever. Those of you who are still skeptical, remember, I'm not preaching any religion or faith to anybody. You make your own decision. It's just like my presentation here tonight. Everything I just presented is hard, indisputable data. Mm-hmm. Do with it what you will. Come to the conclusions you will, but nothing that I presented here tonight can be disputed, and indeed nobody has.
You know, what I wanted to, I was going to ask you earlier, are you familiar with Kate Griggs?
The name rings a bell, but no.
So apparently her husband was in like, he was a special operator officer and operated in the Marines and was involved with all kinds of, you know, deep, dark, dirty stuff with, you know, CIA and stuff like that. Anyway, she did an interview back in 1998. It was like 10 hours long. And somebody sent it to me. One of my followers sent it to me. And I've watched a very good portion of it. Anyway, One of the things that she said in there that I found very interesting was that Leon Trotsky, when he got banished from Russia, when Stalin, obviously when Lenin died, there was a little bit of a struggle for power, and Trotsky was banished and Stalin took over. She made the claim that Trotsky actually converted to Christianity in Mexico. And I had never heard that, and I was curious if you had.
I've never heard that. I'd have to see some receipts.
I agree. I didn't do any research on it. It was just something that came across my radar screen yesterday, last night, as a matter of fact. So I haven't really done any digging into that, but I just was curious in your research history if you'd ever heard that. So I'm actually going to be, I found the 10-hour long video and I broke it up into like basically roughly hour long parts. Yeah. And I'm going to upload that in 10 parts for people to watch so that it's digestible. Very interesting. And it makes a lot of sense when you think, you know, talk about some of the things and not really have anything to do with what you're doing, but it just was with the topic of the show today, but just, you know, with things that are going on in our world.
Yeah. So,
but anyway, that's why I wanted to wait until the very end before I brought it up. I didn't want to, cause it was way too off topic. So anyway, I'm glad that I didn't look at the book before I listened to your presentation of it. That was really good. I felt like I'm a watcher of the show.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. I have to tell you, I wasn't really familiar with the Shroud of Turin. I've heard of it, but that's to the extent of my understanding.
Well, I'll tell you what, on an optimistic note, I have a feeling this is going to become much more known. And I'll tell you why. Mel Gibson was on the Joe Rogan podcast a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
And he said next year he's going to start filming The Resurrection sequel with Jim Caviezel. Mm-hmm. And then he starts talking about The Shroud. It's right about the time that I'm finishing this up. I said, wow, what timing? And he mentioned the Roman coins. I think he mentioned the pollen. He mentioned that they redid the dating on it. So he's talking about the Shroud in conjunction with this film. So I think as part of his movie, it's going to touch on this, or it's going to become a topic. And then we come to find out Trump essentially naming Mel Gibson and Sylvester Stallone as ambassadors and John Voight to make Hollywood great again.
Yeah.
So. And there's no question that there is a spiritual Christian component to the Q operation. No. And so maybe ultimately, because really, Ron, all the political stuff, the economic stuff, that's great. We don't have some kind of spiritual revival in this country.
Well, it's already happening.
It kind of is. You see Trump's spokeswoman,
the
cross she's wearing? Could it get any bigger? I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, I watch the Sean Ryan podcast a lot. Yeah. You know, I really like a lot of the work that he's done, and I mean, he's like a hardcore, outspoken Christian now,
yeah.
And so many others are too.
Yeah.
You know, Hegseth when they were criticizing him because of his tattoo,
right?
You know, right. I mean, there's just a lot. You know, I do absolutely believe we are on the upswing of a huge spiritual revival in this country and in the world and in the world in general.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, it has to be because, you know, these things, you know, historically, when you have these cycles, I mean, we've gotten so bad right now and it's so unnatural. The pendulum swings one way.
It's like the pendulum. And I have said that, you know, the pendulum is either coming up to the apex, it's either at the apex or it's hit the apex and is starting to come back right now. We are on the we're at that point where I don't know if it's there yet, if it's all, if it's right there or if it started to come back. I don't know, but it's, but we're at that, we're as far as we're gonna go to the on the just the shit into the stick, if I may be vulgar about it.
Yeah. Because I'll tell you what, Ron, this year is actually the most powerful tool of potential evangelism as well as protection of faith imaginable. Okay? I mean, it has, look what it did to David Rolfe, atheist filmmaker, sets out to debunk it. Instead, he's offering $1 million to anybody who thinks they can debunk it.
Right.
Look at Barry Schwartz. That's the power of it. And even as I'm working on this piece, putting it together, it's just mind blowing. And it, so it's just amazing to me. Well, it's not amazing. It's understandable that the church and Christianity in general has not used this as like their lead punch, their strongest punch, probably because they figure if we bet all our chips on this and science debunks it, we look like idiots. But I, you know, they don't even have to take an official position on it, and they don't. But I would like to see all of the various denominations of Christianity at least put the forensics out there in everybody's face.
Well, I'd love to see the DNA. I'd like to see DNA if go, you know, if they've got the blood samples and they can ascertain it's AB or AB.
Right.
Let's put it under D.
Well, we got to get this thing opened up again. Not likely to happen under this Pope, who's a communist. But we'll see what this goes. It is bubbling up now, a kind of a movement, the beginnings of pressure to open this up again to a new type of stirp with today's modern voice.
Right.
And I'm confident because if you look at it historically, every time there's a technological advancement, the proofs always go in favor of the shroud. It starts with Segundo Pio's primitive camera. Wow. 33 years later, we got better camera. Then we got stirp. Then we got the spectrometric analysis in the blood, et cetera. So it just seems the more technology and science you throw at this thing, the more God's just, it seems like he's sitting back saying,
yep,
shaking his head, you ain't got nothing. Right?
You know, you really ought to reach out to Lee Strobel. I mean that sincerely.
Yeah.
Because again, he was his story was, is that his wife became a Christian, and he wrote the legal column for going through and looking all all the legal stuff, and he was a research guy, and he literally wrote he's written a couple of books. One of them is called The Case for a Creator, Case for Christ. And there's several other, but it's all case for, because I think he was at one time an attorney or a lawyer, which is why he was qualified to write that column. And I mean, he's a very devout Christian now, but he might be an advocate for getting this, because he's not denominational or anything like that. But it would he might be somebody that could maybe push that a little bit. So anyway. I'm not saying that you want to be a part of that, or if that's even an endeavor you want to go down. But you know, you've taken the time to write this book. It might be worth just an email. So, but anyway, yeah, well, fantastic.
This is definitely something I'm excited about promoting, and it's off to a great start on Amazon. And I'm excited about that because, it's a change of pace for me, but yet. In many ways, I think this is more powerful in people's hearts and minds than the other stuff I write.
I'm actually going to take the copy that I just got, and I'm going to go give it to my mom because she and let her read it. And I'm going to get a copy, and I'm going to send it to another. Yeah. I'm going to get a couple of copies and send them out to some friends.
It's something you can feel good about giving out.
Yeah.
Because believe me, ain't nobody going to come back to you and say, oh, this is wrong, wrong, wrong.
Right.
Just dealing in forensics here. Right. If they want to make a different conclusion, that's fine. Nothing.
Fix your typos.
Yeah. I got typos. Oh no, I had them in the presentation, not in the book, though.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
I transposed. I transposed the number 1350 to 1530. The shroud.
Well, and then you missed number seven. And you missed number seven.
Yeah, I saw that. That's Yeah,
but otherwise, you know, but I mean, I'm having fun and being nitpicky, but fantastic job. This was a welcome. This was a very, very good change of pace. Yeah. So very good job, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
All righty. Well, enjoy your evening, sir. And, I'm glad you still have a house over your head in the middle of winter.
That was a little scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. But thanks again, Mike, and you know, enjoy your weekend, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Okay, thank you, Ron. All right.
Take care. All right, good night.